Iran's anti-government protesters are mobilizing a strike in various cities. A VOA Persian TV producer tells us what they would need to do to have a major impact.
Once it spreads into like the government and all the oil and gas industry, which are the main arteries, then it's very dangerous, and that's where it needs to go.
Plus, how Iran is able to plot assassinations and kidnappings of its opponents overseas. And later in the show, an Israeli human rights group tells us why it's skeptical about the UN Human Rights Council approving a fact-finding mission on Iran.
A lot of times when authoritarian regimes are under scrutiny, the UN actually appoints somewhat apologetic people to take over that investigation.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Online videos indicate that shops in various Iranian cities were closed on Monday and Tuesday in observance of a three-day strike called by anti-government protesters via social media. This is the sound of one video posted by the Hengal organization, apparently showing a street with closed storefronts in the western city of Ilam. VOA cannot independently verify the authenticity of the videos, as it is barred from reporting inside Iran. One person watching the strike is Saman Arbabi, a TV producer for VOA Persian. I spoke to him on the phone and asked what he thinks is significant about it.
Well, the strikes are always very important in these movements, and it was a huge part of the 79 revolution, which crippled the economy, and even now, even though it hasn't been that massive, the Iranian government has reacted very harshly to it because they know this is a very dangerous tipping point. If it becomes a national strike, their days would literally be numbered by like a few weeks or months maybe.
What can you say about how widely this strike has been observed, you know, in the first day or two?
Well, it hasn't been that huge because right now, the strikes need to cover all aspects of the economy. Right now, what we're seeing, the strikes really started by just people calling for strikes for these three dates on social media. And it wasn't like one person calling it out. It just spread out and all these influencers started talking about it. And that's how this thing became what it is today. But it's not that huge because it's just the beginning of it. It's for the markets. It's the merchants in different parts of the country. It's not enough to break the economy's back, but it's something that needs to continue and become a bigger thing. Once it spreads into like the government and all the oil and gas industry, which are the main arteries, then it's very dangerous, and that's where it needs to go. But in my opinion, strikes are something that, you know, if you plan for, it needs to come a little bit later in the game. Not to say it's hurting anything right now, no, because it's keeping the movement and the momentum alive, and it shows unity amongst the Iranians.
Well, why later in the game?
Because it needs to be planned. The way it worked in 79 was the strikes came a little bit later in after the protests, because it needs to be a much unified thing. And it can't be just like the merchants in a couple of bazaars in Isfahan or Tehran. It needs to be something that needs to build momentum and then get to the big stuff. So it needs to, right now we need more protests, we need more students, we need some of that stuff, and then like step two or three, then the strikes on a plan need to start and then begin, you know, it's sort of like the last phase, really, honestly. Then it becomes like a nationwide thing. When the government shuts down, when the natural resource industries and the main income of the country shuts down, then the government is really out.
Well, I wanted to ask you about one other, you know, big development from Iran in the last few days. It was the Iranian chief prosecutor Montazeri making this vague statement about the morality police. That's the unit in whose custody Mahsa Amini died back in September, that it was shut down. But there was no real confirmation of that from other parts of the Iranian government. So what have people been saying inside Iran about this vague statement?
What they say is this was basically misinformation, disinformation pushed by the regime. That's what they say, in order to take focus away from the main issues, such as, you know, like basically to soften up the Western media and politicians believing that this is happening. But I don't even think they're that smart and organized. I think just this guy just opened up his mouth, who's not even responsible for something like that. And that kind of spread like wildfire in the West, which is very irresponsible, in my opinion. And shows how little some of these Western outlets understand or know about the Iranian politics, because the hijab, mandatory hijab, is part of the Iranian constitution. It is one of the founding pillars of the constitution, and it's been there for 43 years. And removal of hijab is a serious crime, as you've seen yourself. You know, they put a lot of money into it, and they punish people severely for something like that. And if you wake up in the morning, they say it's removed, it's just ridiculous to even believe that. It's as if you woke up this morning and someone outside said, yeah, the Second Amendment, it was removed from the U.S. Constitution. It's not like that. Yeah, it doesn't happen by some dude just saying.
There's more of a process.
It's a huge process. Yeah, it's part of their legitimacy in the government. And for that to just be spread out that quickly without doing much research or understanding of how the Iranian theocracy works, it's just really absurd.
Well, Salman Arbabi, VOA Persian TV producer, thank you for being with us on the line from New York on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael.
The Washington Post is reporting that Iran's government has stepped up efforts to kidnap and kill government officials, activists, and journalists around the world, including in the United States. The newspaper cited government documents and interviews with 15 officials in Washington, Europe, and the Middle East, all of whom spoke on condition of anonymity. One of the experts quoted in that story is Norman Rule, the former U.S. National Intelligence Manager for Iran. I asked him in a phone call what he sees as the strengths of the Iranian government's capabilities to target its opponents overseas.
The primary strength of the Iranian actions is they often use surrogates who are not Iranian officials. Now, there will be some who say that this is a weakness, that these individuals are less controllable and perhaps less trained. However, for the nature of the operations that are being conducted, their training is sufficient. And indeed, what happens in almost every case is that the government managing the area where an attack or kidnapping or something was expected to take place prosecutes the individual for the action. But Iran generally escapes serious consequences. So the greatest strength is that they use surrogates.
And what would you say are the weaknesses of these kinds of plots?
Well, the weaknesses would be a lack of control, a lack of operational discipline, an ability to initiate an operation. But once you have an amateur involved in its execution, particularly if the amateur comes under the scrutiny of local security, they lack the broader training, the broader operational discipline to escape detection.
How effectively have the U.S. and its allies responded to these operations up to now, because they have been reported in a variety of countries?
I think you have to answer that in a couple of different ways. So I think you have to measure first the success in terms of, have we been able to protect the targets of these operations? And I think that's a mixed case internationally. We do much better in the United States, but in Europe or in Iraq, for example, or Turkey, I think it's a different situation. The second way I'd measure this would be in terms of, have we succeeded in deterring Iran from undertaking these operations? And I think there we, the international community, have not been successful. In fact, we failed. And the evidence for that is that these operations continue in a variety of different geographies in considerable scale. I mean, consider what we've seen in the United States, where former officials, private individuals, were being targeted for potential assassination, an individual for kidnapping in the United States. You have threats against journalists in London this year. You've had attempts to explode bombs at opposition rallies in France involving individuals in a number of European countries. So I think the scale of that geography and the nature of the operations and the sort of the drumbeat of every year or two tells you we're not successful in deterring Iran by our responses.
What do you think a more effective deterrence strategy would look like?
So this sort of operation, this sort of activity is producing in our world sometimes a tectonic response. The threats against former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for example, or the attempted kidnapping of Masih Alinejad, they gain wide publicity. But there's very little ripple effect inside of Iran's senior-most leadership. You don't see actions that touch Iran's decision-making inner circle. I think what we do is we undertake sanctions against people who generally have little money or no assets abroad to seize. They don't travel, and indeed, the Iranian government doesn't want them to travel. So you've got to identify ways to touch the supreme leader and his inner decision-making circle. So there, you have to touch parts of the Iranian economy or parts of the Iranian government that constrain the other operations or other activities of the Iranian government. So, for example, if we've had hundreds of Russian intelligence officers expelled from Europe, why don't we have, it's a smaller intelligence system and a smaller diplomatic system, why aren't we having dozens of Iranian diplomats expelled from Europe? Why do we allow, for example, President Raisi to come to the United Nations? We've had President Obama reject visas for people. We've had Reagan. We could have used that occasion as an opportunity to say, to the international community, to say there are consequences for these operations, and we failed to do so.
What do you think is holding back the United States and its European partners from just expelling, you know, a large number of Iranian government personnel from their territories?
Well, probably the first consequence of such an action would be Iran duplicating that in Iran itself for Western embassies. And in fairness, those embassies have important consular operations for their many civilians who are often detained by Iranians or need embassy support in those countries. So I could imagine the conversation in that regard taking place. Likewise, I think there's often a sense of if we just prosecute the individuals involved and send a tough message, that Iran will understand that this is a failed system and they need to knock it off. I don't think that's been very successful.
Well, what are you going to be looking for, you know, going forward about, you know, how Iran is conducting these plots? What do you think we should all pay attention to?
Right now, Iran is going through a turbulent period of unrest. And as part of its response to that unrest, it needs to show defiance to the international community and to demonstrate it that it can still project power. So we've seen, for example, missile firings against Iraq. We've seen the sale of drones to Russia. We should expect Iran to continue these operations simply because they have plenty of proxies. They don't mind going to prison. And it sends the message that Iran remains capable of such offensive activities. So I think in the near term, we shouldn't be surprised if Iran continues these activities, perhaps in areas where they feel a little more comfortable working, Iraq, Turkey, as history has shown, parts of Europe.
Well, Norman Rule, former senior U.S. intelligence official, thank you for speaking with us on Flashpoint Iran from Abu Dhabi in the UAE.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Great questions.
Visit voanews.com and click the Iran tab at the top of the page for updates on Iran throughout the day. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The UN Human Rights Council is preparing to set up a fact-finding mission to independently investigate alleged human rights violations in Iran related to the anti-government protests that began in September. The Geneva-based UN body took the unprecedented step of approving the Iran-focused mission in a special session last month. One of the human rights advocates who addressed the session via video from Israel is Anne Hertzberg, legal advisor for the group NGO Monitor. Hertzberg said creating a year-long fact-finding mission is not enough and called for a permanent investigation of Iran. I spoke to her on the phone and asked what precedent there is for the Human Rights Council to engage in permanent investigations.
Yes, so it's quite notable that last year the Human Rights Council created a permanent commission of inquiry against Israel, ostensibly to look at the, quote, root causes of the Arab-Israeli conflict, although they've only been being very critical of Israel. They've done no examination of Palestinian or Arab state contribution to the conflict or Iran's contribution to the conflict. And, you know, so what was interesting to me in the resolution and the fact-finding mission that they voted on was that it's a one-off, it's a one-year commission. I'm not really sure how much they're going to be able to accomplish. And lately, it seemed like there had been more moves in the Human Rights Council when they are establishing these commissions of inquiry, even though they're only, except for Israel, are just one-offs. There's really a emphasis on trying to gather evidence for criminal trials or other types of litigation, civil litigation. And that was not really a focus of this fact-finding mission. So on the one hand, while it was good that, you know, that they are having a fact-finding mission, I'm not really sure what it's going to accomplish in the end.
Well, I was going to ask what kind of results you're expecting from this one-off fact-finding mission, because Iran doesn't really have a track record of allowing UN human rights investigators to come into the country.
Yeah, I do think it is going to have limited utility. For sure, the fact that they're not going to have access to Iran, most likely. You know, this is always an excuse, let's say in the case of Israel with their commission of inquiry, that the UN officials always say, oh, well, we can't comment on what is happening to Israelis because we can't get access to the territory. But of course, you know, and especially post-COVID, you know, there are things like Zoom and many other ways to speak to people. And certainly Iran has a large expat diaspora community, you know, with whom they can consult with. So, you know, they can still do their work. However, I'm not sure the utility. And I think a major factor is who is going to be appointed on the commission, because a lot of times when authoritarian regimes are under scrutiny, the UN actually appoints somewhat apologetic people to take over that investigation. Or the process to appoint these commissioners is secret. There's no transparency surrounding it. So currently they're appointed officially by the president of the Human Rights Council, but the names are usually proposed by UN officials, and there's a lot of state lobbying for who is selected. So we don't know what's going to happen. The current president is quite good, and I think is careful, and much better than his predecessor from Fiji, who was not careful in terms of her appointments. The current president is much more careful. So I expect he'll do a good job in terms of selecting people who have unbiased records and who are serious and, you know, really intend to do a good job with their investigation. But it's really unknown. And then the other issue is just, will they get the funding for it? The UN budget discussions are going on right now in New York. And so that's sort of an open question, like how much money are they going to allocate to the process?
Well, what does NGO Monitor intend to do in the coming weeks and months on Iran?
Yeah, so for us, depending on the modalities, like when the mission gets going, you know, we will make a submission in all likelihood to the mission, highlighting issues that we think are important for them to look at. And then also when the reports are presented to the council, their first update is to the council in June. So we will be there then. And also the full report will then be presented in March 2024. So again, you know, we hope to be able to be at the council and make a statement, commenting on the report and possibly also doing some kind of analysis on the report, highlighting, you know, some of these issues surrounding terrorism and Iran's role in that.
Right. Well, we will look out for that. Anne Hertzberg, UN representative for NGO Monitor, joining us from Jerusalem. Thank you so much for being on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Biden administration has responded to Iran's acceleration of nuclear activities that could be weaponized by saying the U.S. continues to believe that diplomacy is the best way to prevent Tehran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Iran denies seeking to become nuclear armed. But could it be persuaded to do so by watching how its nuclear-armed ally Moscow has defied the West by continuing the Russian war on Ukraine? Michael Allen is a former member of the George W. Bush National Security Council. I caught up with him at a Washington forum last week and asked if there are any signs of Iran's leaders trying to follow Russia's example.
Well, it's certainly been reported on in the press and among experts that that must be a factor in the Iranians' thinking as they contemplate whether to come back to the JCPOA. And of course, that makes sense. The Russia-Ukraine war is the biggest geopolitical event in a very long time, but certainly of the last year. And so inevitably, they're thinking and talking among themselves of, did this give the Russians an extra measure of protection? Because the United States is asking the Ukrainians not to use NATO weapons inside of Russia. And if that gave them an extra measure of protection, is that because they have nuclear weapons? And I think the Iranians would reasonably conclude, yes, that's the reason.
You also talked about in your presentation how new ways are needed to try to constrain Iran's proliferation activities. What are those new ways?
Well, I think the United States can lead an effort to impose and reimpose all sorts of sanctions against Iran. We have tremendous advantages in being the reserve currency and having financial tentacles all over the earth. But I think we would be better off if the Europeans and our allies in Asia also helped with the implementation of sanctions. I think as broad-based as they can be is certainly the way to go. And I believe that that way we can ensure that there's not a hole in the boat, that the Iranians feel the pressure from the West, and that may induce them to make greater concessions if indeed the Biden administration wants to try and revive the Iranian nuclear deal.
Well, the Biden administration said that the U.S. experience of having maximum pressure sanctions at the end of the Trump administration didn't achieve the desired results. So how effective do you think sanctions can be in terms of putting Iran in a box, or do other measures have to be considered, something like a credible military deterrent?
Definitely a credible military deterrent helps. And I don't know that sanctions alone will achieve what we want. But it's part of a larger whole-of-government strategy where you have diplomacy, where you have a credible military deterrent out there, and you have sanctions. And then you hope over time that this campaign will yield fruit. It is true that was the view of the Biden administration. I knew they wanted to get to a deal. I wish they had held in a little while longer and tried to truly improve the Obama-era JCPOA, but I think they were ready to go for a deal. I call it zeal for the deal, and they went for it as soon as they could. And it's been a long time that they've been negotiating with the Iranians, but, you know, we know where they're ready to go.
What do you foresee as the Biden administration's next steps here, in the coming months, given that Iran has continued to make some advances with its nuclear program? Which of these new methods that you think should be adopted are realistically going to be adopted by the United States?
Realistically, I'm worried that they won't be. We may have some sanctions that come out. I probably would style them more as symbolic. I'll be really surprised if they're broad-based sanctions against the Iranians. I think we are waiting and seeing what's going on with the protests inside of Iran. And then I think that may have an effect on what the Iranian regime's calculations might be. If indeed they get through the protests that are all over Iran right now.
Michael Allen, former member of the George W. Bush National Security Council, thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks so much for having me.
That brings us to the end of this week's program. There's more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Michael Lippin. On behalf of the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week.